The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
These modern autocrats corrupt elections. They know, unlike their 20th century brethren, that they cannot pass an enabling act and simply dismantle democracy overnight altogether, because democracy has seeped into public consciousness in a way that it hadn't in 1930. And so what they do is they maintain what someone once told me, I love this phrase, are Potemkin democracies. Democracy is really just on the surface. Think about it. In the last 2 years, Vladimir Putin, Sisi, Erdogan, Maduro, Orban, they've all won elections, right? But not really. I mean, Sisi had a guy from his own party run against him. These weren't really elections. So what does Trump do when he comes to office? First thing he does, stands up the Pence-Kobach Commission to perpetrate this phony idea that there's rampant voter fraud in order to clamp down on the kinds of voters who are likely to potentially oppose Trump in the future. And Protect Democracy jumped in and was part of the successful effort to shut down Pence-Kobach. So these are the things that are in, because these are the things that autocrats do.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 19th, 2019. Ian Basson served in the White House counsel's office under President Obama. At the dawn of the Trump administration, he became the impresario behind the litigating organization Protect Democracy, which has become an increasingly cross-ideological mechanism for using litigation to protect democratic values. We talked about the differences between Protect Democracy and more conventional litigating organizations. We talked about what sort of projects they do take on and what sort of projects they don't take on. And we talked about the role that litigation can and cannot play in preserving the norms that make democracy vibrant. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 384, Ian Basson on Protecting Democracy. Ian, let's start by clearing the decks of what is going to be an unusually extensive disclosure of for the Lawfare podcast. You are, among other things, my lawyer on a number of matters. So let's be candid with the listenership about that and just describe the range of projects that we've worked on, none of which are together, none of which are the subject of the current podcast. So let's see, what have you guys represented me on?
A number of FOIA cases, including trying to prove that the president was lying when he told a joint session of Congress that he'd received information from the Department of Justice proving that the majority of terrorism was committed by the Foreign Board, and several other FOIA cases on the state of FBI after Comey's departure, and I think before as well. The effort to get the Watergate roadmap unsealed. This is the document that the Watergate special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, had his grand jury transmit to the House Judiciary Committee, laying out the factual basis of what he had found of what looked like crimes committed by the president. And most recently, and this may not even cover the entire waterfront, you'll tell me if I've missed anything, most recently, the successful effort, I should say all of these have been remarkably successful effort to force the Department of Justice to eat a little bit of crow and admit some errors on the report it issued at the direction of the president's Muslim ban executive order that also sought to lay a factual predicate for the Muslim ban by making the case through data which we argued, and they to some degree admitted, misconstrued the degree to which the foreign foreign-born were responsible for terrorism in the United States. I think it would be good to talk a little bit about that. I think in part because, yes, we represent you, and it's important that we disclose that to the listeners, but these have been, I think, really creative ideas that you and Lawfare have brought forward that have been really important to holding in check some of the things that we've seen that have been transgressions over the last 2 years and helping the American people understand what's going on. So yes, we should be up front and disclose that, but these have been some important successful projects.
So I just want to make sure the disclosure is complete. I want to add one other thing, which is that you guys represented Susan Hennessy and me in an amicus brief we filed in front of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which I believe, to give you an idea, listeners, an idea of how secretive the FISA court is, I believe that brief has still not been accepted formally, even by the court, or rejected, by the way. We filed it. We filed a motion for leave to file it, and the court has simply not said anything in response to that, at least not that I've seen.
Right.
So we will, as you suggest, we may make reference to some of these matters as we talk, but you're actually not here to talk about in general about stuff that you've done with me or Susan or any of the other Lawfare or Scott Anderson or any of the other Lawfare people who've worked with you guys, but rather a kind of more general discussion of sort of the state of democracy and kind of the role of litigation in protecting democratic values and that in the national security and other contexts in the current era. So, Ian, start us out by giving us a little pressy on Protect Democracy, what it is and how you guys started it.
You know, if you're anything like me, our listeners are anything like me, November 8, 2016 was a bit of a shock. And I think for a lot of us, our first impression was that something rather anomalous had happened in that we didn't expect that the United States could ever elect someone like Donald Trump to the presidency. And we isolated, a lot of us, myself, our view to that this was something anomalous. And it was sad and devastating in this particular kind of way. I remember my wife and I were in Philadelphia for Election Day and getting ready to come back up to New York on the rainy morning, the morning after. And my wife went into the Philadelphia train station to buy an umbrella and came out very upset because the person who had sold her an umbrella was wearing a hijab. And she felt like she didn't know what to say other than, I'm sorry. And that was, I think, for a lot of us, the initial reaction. But very quickly after that, a different picture came into view. As we started to talk to some of the scholars who have been studying democracy around the world, who will tell you a very different story about what happened on November 8, 2016, which was that it was not just a product of American politics and what's happening in this country, but more a product of something happening globally. So we have been witnessing a decline of democracy over the last 15 or so years. Freedom House, which has been studying democracy around the world since the end of World War II, and tracking it on an annual basis, shows that democracy spread to more countries and improved in the countries that it was in a pretty much upward trajectory throughout the latter half of the 20th century until about 2005, when it begins to go in reverse. And we know the stories of places like Turkey and Hungary and Poland and Venezuela and now Brazil. But this has been a trend, and the United States, it turns out, was not immune from it. And so we set about with a group of former White House and Department of Justice attorneys to learn the lessons of what had been happening in these other countries that were a little bit further down this autocratic road than we were, to try to prevent that from happening here. And we formed an organization called Protect Democracy to do that.
All right. So the original crew that started Protect Democracy, and when it was started, a lot of people focused on this involved a group of people who came out of the Obama White House Counsel's office. Tell me about both the original crew and how it has evolved since the early days of putting the organization together.
Well, within about 3 days of the election, I myself, who had served in the first 3 years of the Obama administration in the White House Counsel office, part of my portfolio was making sure that executive branch appointees follow the rules. Right. And you realize when you do that, that so many of those rules are not legally binding. They're just custom, tradition, norm. I remember I had three binders in my White House office that had memos going back to the Eisenhower White House that White House counsels and chiefs of staff had sent to White House staff laying out for them the constraints on how they carried out their responsibilities. And we would go back to that essentially as White House common law and say, how did people do it in the past? And I connected right after the election with another former White House counsel attorney named Justin Florence to say, what happens if you actually have an administration and even a movement behind it that in many ways rose to power on a promise of doing away with all of those norms and constraints? And one of the initial insights was, well, there are very few people who know the details of all of those arcane rules and policies, and don't we have somewhat of a responsibility as some of the people who have been privileged enough and privy to what those norms and rules have been to get that information out there? And we teamed up with another group of former Department of Justice attorneys to talk about how to do that. And we'll say we reached out initially to some of our conservative friends from the Federalist Society, knowing that they, too, had privately expressed concerns about Trump. And they, hey, why don't you do this with us? This is really about rule of law issues that should bring us together across our different policy differences. And the response we got was, well, I want to wait and see. And so we had to really make a strategic calculation, which was, do we wait until we can have a really cross-ideological group of people to confront this challenge to our democracy? Or do we, to quote sort of Don Rumsfeld, go to war with the army we've got? At the time, which had been people who had served in Democratic administrations. And we opted to do the latter on the theory that one of two things would happen. Either we would be wrong in our fear that Trump would represent a, you know, attack on democracy and a more autocratic style of government coming to the United States, in which case we would simply close up shop and go out of business as our raison d'etre would actually not exist. Or, more troublingly, we would be right, and Trump would represent the coming of this global autocratic threat to the United States, in which case more and more conservatives would, having waited and seen, be as alarmed as we were and join the cause. And I suppose for worse and maybe a little bit for better, it turned out that second thing did happen. I think nobody questions or doubts anymore that what we're dealing with is an autocratic-minded president who is engaged in an assault on the foundation of our democracy. And so we have had a number of conservatives join the team since we launched. We're now quite a cross-ideological group. I should say last week we hired a group of new staffers, including one former Weekly Standard staffer and one former Elizabeth Warren staffer. I think we're probably the only company in the country that brought two people from those backgrounds on last week. So because the nature of this fight is one that should not, as you have talked about, separate us by party. We need a coalition of all democratic forces, the line you've raised, and you and I have been part of a lot of conversations between people who have very different policy preferences for the world, but agree on some fundamental things about American democracy that are currently in danger.
All right. So let's talk about the parameters of that fight as you understand it, because I think a lot of people would look at and by the way, when I articulated the idea of a coalition of all democratic forces, which I did in the run-up on Lawfare, in the run-up to the 2016 election, fully believing that Trump would lose, the piece in which I imagined him winning, I specifically identified a full court press litigation effort as an essential component of what the coalition of all democratic forces would need to do. And so to me, there's something very intuitive about what you guys are putting together here. But to a lot of people, what you're putting together just looks like a kind of anti-Trump litigation team. And so my question is, what makes Protect Democracy different from all the other groups that are engaged in litigation against the Trump administration? And what are the aspects of the Trump administration policy that might be very controversial that you guys would never get involved with as a litigation matter?
Well, let's start with our mission, which is explicitly to prevent American democracy from declining into a more authoritarian form of government. Now, that's a pretty big, bold, ambitious mission, right? So what does that mean, and how do we go about trying to do that? Well, we've essentially approached it by saying there are going to be really three phases to this challenge, and we are absolutely acutely aware that this is something that's going to require way more than just a small but growing nonprofit. This is going to take a national movement to succeed in that mission. But how do we go about it? So three phases. Phase one, very much a rearguard action, right? Right now, even if you view, as we do, Trump as symptom, not cause of the problem, he is certainly an acute threat in terms of exacerbating the slide into a more autocratic form of government. And so phase one, the rearguard action, is just prevent him from caving in the ceiling of our democratic norms and institutions. So that's really a get under the ceiling with your arms and hold up the ceiling beam, right? That's the first phase. And the best way to do that is if you can get a court to issue an order saying, don't do that. Don't, you know, cross that line. Don't bring in that, don't tear down that ceiling rafter. That's the strongest medicine that you can get. So we started by hiring up a lot of lawyers and using litigation as a primary tool, although certainly not the only tool. The second phase, though, is what we're calling our roadmap for renewal, which is at some point you want to be able to walk away from the ceiling beam, not hold it up with your arms, and not have the ceiling cave in. So that means taking the sort of cracking wooden ceiling beam and replacing it with a steel one. And so we look back at the post-Nixon era as a model here, where you really had about 7 years after Nixon, really from 72 to 79, when you had a real host of bipartisan reforms that were passed that were designed to both repair the damage that Nixon had done and strengthen the institutions that he had exposed as vulnerable. And I think we're going to have, post-Trump, a similar window. Of course, it won't be 7 years. It'll be like 7 seconds, because that's the speed at which we move these days. We've got to be ready for it, right? And so we put forward a legislative proposal, our roadmap for renewal, for the 2020 candidates and for Congress, of what should happen that we need to work on now, post-Trump, to sort of strengthen that ceiling. And then there's a third phase, which is, first off, how did this happen to begin with? How did the termites get into the foundation and start eating away at it, right? So recently we just hired Yasha Monk, a wonderful scholar who's been studying the state of democracy in the United States around the world. And his research has shown that young people in the United States, millennials, are far less committed to democracy than older generations of Americans. Okay, so why is that, and what do we need to do about it to keep it strong for another generation? And then similarly, is this the right structure for the 21st century? Might there not need to be certain changes in our system to make it as vibrant in the 21st century as we would like it to be? Okay, so that's sort of the three phases. Now, to your question of, well, what about this is just sort of not a anti-Trump effort, is we're focused solely on the dangers posed to those democratic institutions that separate us as a liberal democracy from more authoritarian regimes. We are not focused on the kinds of policy issues that left and right do disagree, should disagree, and that should be the subject of elections and debates. So, for example, the president has attacked the Affordable Care Act. I worked for President Obama. I worked on the Affordable Care Act. I like the Affordable Care Act. I think it's good. We're not going to touch that. That's a policy issue. It should be the subject of elections and debate. Similarly, I happen to think that we should have a much higher marginal tax rate on high earners. That's my personal preference. It's my personal policy belief. It is something we absolutely would not touch at Protect Democracy, because that's just not as central to the rules of the game. And so there's a lot of groups out there, on a personal level, I like what they're doing, I agree with them, that are fighting the policy initiatives of this administration, the conservative policy initiatives, or just the radically crazy far-right policy initiative. That's not what we're about. We're about making sure that we actually have a house in which, for example, Bill Kristol and I, and we work with Kristol now, can disagree about marginal tax rates and resolve that in a peaceful way, because the rules of how our democracy works are functioning and we all agree on them. And we've got to get back to a place where that's true again.
So let's explore this question of what's in and what's out for Protect Democracy, which is something that I've, struggled with as well. You know, for example, I personally have regarded the Trump administration's judicial nominations as not within this realm, as in the sense, that they are, precisely what any traditional conservative president would have done. And you can, as a liberal, agree with, or you can disagree. You can think it's, Brett Kavanaugh is the scariest thing in the world, but scary in precisely the way for liberals that Brett Kavanaugh would have been scary had he been nominated by George W. Bush or by Jeb Bush, right? On the other hand, some people come to me and they say, Ben, that's ridiculous. One thing that authoritarians always do is they make an energetic push to create ideologically like-minded judiciaries. And the energetic judicial nominations efforts of this administration fit directly into that pattern. So when you look at it, obviously you can't litigate on the subject of judicial nominations, but when you look at it from Protect Democracy's point of view, how should we understand the concerted, serious effort of the Trump administration and probably one of its most successful efforts? Should we understand it as traditional conservatism of the sort that left and right will legitimately disagree against about, or should we understand it as a part of this thing that you are trying to, you know, this democratic degradation that you are trying to keep the rafters of the ceiling up with respect to?
Well, one correction I think I'd make on sort of what is typical of autocrats in terms of trying to pack the courts with ideological allies is oftentimes that's done through means that are not the normal and proper channels for doing it. So, for example, in Poland, when the Law and Justice Party came into power, they did a number of things to rig the process by which they put judges on the court. So, for example, the outgoing opposition party had already named several judges that were supposed to go onto the high court. The Law and Justice Party refused to seat those judges, pulled them back, tried to put on its own people. They then changed the retirement age to sort of accelerate the retirement of judges that they didn't like in order to ram through judges that they did. So I think there's a process issue with how that's done. And there are some parallels to that we're seeing here, right? The Merrick Garland process is the one that stands out the most. Now, sure, there are arguments to be made that, like, the Senate gets a confirmation vote and they can decide how to deploy it and what to do with it, but there certainly was something wildly out of whack with the absolute refusal of Mitch McConnell to even hold hearings or consider an appointment by a sitting, duly elected president who had a vacancy to fill in the Supreme Court. So the fact that that seat was essentially, and I think this is the right word to use, stolen, that does start to look a lot like what you see in these other countries. On the other hand, the nominees to the lower courts, while I agree with you, I probably disagree with the vast majority of them on their ideology, a lot of them probably are the people that a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio might have nominated. I think it's pretty hard to draw a very explicit and clear line because you could get to a place where the ideology of a nominee to the court, so take someone like a Kavanaugh, is so extremely deferential to either something like executive power or to the power of, for example, a party to entrench its power through gerrymandering or tools like that, that you might want to say, hey, you know what, if this sort of judge is confirmed to a court at the time that you have an executive that's trying to aggrandize executive power, working with a party that's trying to entrench its power, you can actually create a cycle that is so dangerous to democracy that it requires speaking out against it. I think it's pretty hard to draw a firm line on that, although I would say that Protect Democracy has not come out and opposed any judge thus far in the Trump administration, because I think there's a truth to the fact that they are judges that a lot of conservatives would support. I think there's a different way of thinking about what's in and what's out, though, which is we went and we talked to a lot of the scholars that have been studying these autocrats that have been rising around the world. They constitute now our advisory board, and asked them, so what does the roadmap look like? What do these autocrats do so that we can be prepared to try to prevent it from happening here? And they all gave answers that essentially boil down to six things, and this is really the what's in terms of the things that Protect Democracy works on. So here's what they are. One, they will try to politicize independent institutions like law enforcement, the civil service, the military. Two, they will use the government to spread disinformation, to confuse the public into not being able to hold their government accountable. Three, these executives will aggrandize power into their own hands and try to undercut the institutions that are supposed to be a check on executive power, like legislators, like so-called judges, like the states, like the enemy of the people, media, all of those things that could check an executive. Fourth, they will quash dissent, and they will do it in a way that is not the traditional, the way we think about government censorship, where the government simply says you can't say that. No, what these modern autocrats will do is when you have someone dissenting or speaking up, they'll essentially work behind the scenes to squeeze that person's pocketbook. So if that person has a business, making sure no one shops there anymore, making sure their shipments slow down at the ports until the person is forced to choose between their activism and their livelihood. Fifth, they'll delegitimize minority and vulnerable populations. And this is an interesting one because a lot of these autocrats come to power with just plurality support. So again, looking at Poland, the Law and Justice Party there originally came to power with only a very bare minority plurality support because they had essentially a similar context to the jungle Republican primary of 2016 where all of the opposition fractured then rose to power. Now, if you come to power without majority support, how do you claim a mandate to govern? So for example, if you, I don't know, lost the popular vote by 3 million votes, you might say, well, 3 to 4 million brown people voted illegally, and but for them, I do have a mandate to govern, right? So that's a very typical tactic. And then sixth and lastly, these modern autocrats corrupt elections. They know, unlike their 20th century brethren, that they cannot pass an enabling act and simply dismantle democracy overnight altogether because democracy has seeped into public consciousness in a way that it hadn't in 1930. And so what they do is they maintain what someone once told me, I love this phrase, are Potemkin democracies. Democracy is really just on the surface. Think about it. In the last 2 years, Vladimir Putin, Sisi, Erdogan, Maduro, Orban, they've all won elections, right? But not really. I mean, Sisi had a guy from his own party run against him. These weren't really elections. So what does Trump do when he comes to office? First thing he does, stands up the Pence-Kobach Commission to perpetrate this phony idea that there's rampant voter fraud in order to clamp down on the kinds of voters who are likely to potentially oppose Trump in the future. And Protect Democracy jumped in and was part of the successful effort to shut down Pence-Kobach. So these are the things that are in because these are the things that autocrats do.
All right. So that leaves just a lot of stuff not within, you know, a lot of the controversies that we think of as central to who the Trump administration, what the Trump administration is, either outside the focus or ambiguously within the focus. I want to identify a few of them and just have you sort of talk a little bit about, you know, what aspects of it are in and what aspects of it are out. The southern border, right? We have a long running debate about what the form of border security should be. And how much of it should be, and immigration. It does implicate some of the issues that you're describing. On the other hand, it is a long-running left-right dispute in the United States that reasonable people disagree about. How do you evaluate it for Protect Democracy purposes?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't taken a position on, you know, the wisdom of the policy of what sorts of border security measures should be appropriate or not. That's really a policy decision that policymakers should make. On the other hand, if the president were to, as he's threatened to do, declare a national state of emergency in order to aggrandize powers in the hands of the executive at the expense of the legislature because he can't get the legislature to do what he wants, well, that's straight out of the autocrat's playbook.
Let's talk about state law. You know, when you guys were started, you were really focused on actions of the Trump administration, but you all have also filed court actions involving state governments, state elections. What's the relationship there, and to what extent are you guys focused on the federal government versus the states?
So Louis Brandeis famously called the states laboratories of democracy. What we're seeing now is the states become laboratories of undemocracy, where the states are essentially experimenting with new ways of harming democratic institutions that if they go unchallenged or unchecked are going to float up to the federal level. So let me cite a couple. During the Georgia gubernatorial election, Brian Kemp was serving both as the Secretary of State in charge of overseeing the election and as a candidate in the election. Now, this has happened before. It's not the first time it's happened, but he really went out of his way in quite egregious ways to use the powers of the Secretary of State's office to interfere in the electoral process in ways that were designed to help his candidacy. So we challenged that under the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. Justice K. Kennedy and the Caperton opinion a couple years ago made the point that no man under the due process clause can be a judge in his own case. Well, that should be just as true in an election as it is in a judicial environment. And we were successful at getting Brian Kemp to resign. Well, in fact, we had an emergency hearing 2 days after the election before Kemp was able to preside over a recount or certify the results to force him from being a part of the process, to remove him as part of the process. And his lawyers actually came into court at the emergency PI hearing and tendered his resignation in order to moot out the case. We turned around and then did the same thing and filed a case in Florida challenging Rick Scott for doing the same thing, for being a candidate in the race while at the same time as governor, having pretty important roles in overseeing the results of that at the time, too close to call election. He was the chair of the state candidate board as governor while he was also a candidate. We got a wonderful federal court decision there adopting whole cloth our legal theory that indeed the due process clause does provide checks on someone being a candidate in a race in which they also have some gubernatorial responsibilities or powers overseeing that race and using those powers to interfere. That's an important precedent for 2020 when President Trump is going to have a whole lot of federal powers that he could potentially use to try to tilt the electoral playing field in his favor, which should not be allowed to do that. That's one situation. Another situation is, if you remember during the Republican special election in Alabama, you had calls from a lot of Republican people out there that the election should be postponed so that Republicans could replace Roy Moore on the ballot because they were afraid he was likely to lose. There were some serious conversations that took place between, as we understand it, the majority leader, Mitch McConnell's office in the White House, about pressuring Governor KIV in Alabama to do that. Now, thankfully, the governor resisted and didn't do that, but we were prepared to step in and challenge there and actually published a memo on the Protect Democracy website about all of the ways in which that would be unlawful, because we were very afraid that if that norm got established there, you might see that played out at the federal level and other places. And then lastly, the third scenario you're seeing now in North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Michigan, this effort by losing parties to use a lame duck session to strip powers away from, for example, the governorship or the attorney general's office, after that party has lost control of those offices, even though the voters voted on who to put in those offices with an understanding of what powers the people they were electing were going to have. If these instances are not checked, they are going to become the new model that float up to the federal level, and it threatened our democracy at the federal level.
Okay, Ian, I want to push you on this, because there is this thing that all of the state-level examples that you just identified, as well as the litigations against the Trump administration, all have in common, which is that you guys are litigating.
They're Republicans.
They're all Republicans. And
yeah,
so there's
yeah.
there's kind of this elephant here in the room, which is that, you know, you're describing this as a cross-ideological effort, and it's all about protecting democracy. But the skeptic is going to say protecting democracy sure looks a whole lot like suing Republicans. And so my question is, reconcile that. Are all the major threats to democracy right now coming from Republicans, or are you gearing up to do a whole lot of litigation against, you know, Democratic state-level administrations? There is no federal Democratic administration, of course. Or conversely, is maybe the organization less cross-ideological than you aspire for it to be?
Well, I think we have to start with a reality level setting, which is this. American democracy was eroding before Donald Trump came into office. And so it is not solely the cause of Trump that we're in this position. Both Democrats and Republicans have contributed to the decline of our democratic norms and institutions. That said, not in equal measure by any stretch of the imagination, the modern current Republican Party is an autocratic party that has essentially said, whatever this leader does and whatever we need to do to stay in power, we will do. So it's not an equal playing field between Democrats and Republicans on the threats to our democracy. And so if you're trying to protect democratic institutions, that's just the backdrop. Now, that said, the way we approach this is, if we can put together cross ideological alliances to protect our institutions, we will do that. So, for example, we have a lawsuit in South Carolina challenging the vulnerabilities of the South Carolina voting machine system, in which our plaintiffs are a Democrat and a Republican. And we do that in a lot of instances. But we also have a rule within the organization, which is while we will look to challenge any infringement on democratic norms and institutions that fits within our mission that we have capacity to take on, if a Democrat is robbing a bank, we don't need to also find a Republican bank robber in order to prosecute. But we're not afraid to call out Democrats when they transgress these things either. So just recently, I was publicly critical of incoming New York Attorney General Tish James. And I know Chuck Rosenberg had a great piece on Lawfare about this as well, because she seems to be engaging in the same type of politicization of law enforcement that we have been criticizing Trump for. And so we're not afraid to speak out on that. And I look forward also to hopefully engaging in the New York state lawsuit that the National Rifle Association has brought against the Cuomo administration for apparently what appears to be the New York administration carrying out a bunch of regulatory challenges against the NRA that at least appear from the governor's statement to be based out of some animus towards the NRA's unpopular political positions in New York State. So we'll absolutely challenge that when it happens. But the problem is, it's not an even score at this point. The Republican Party is further down this road than the Democratic Party is.
One more question, and then I'll let you go. As you look forward over the next 2 years, as opposed to the last 2 years, how do you see the, you know, you laid out these three phases that you imagine. How do you see us shifting between those phases in the coming months and years? What do you expect Protect Democracy to be doing and expect if we have this conversation 2 years from now? How will the second 2 years look different from the first 2 years?
Well, I think we're going to be moving more from the, I hope, more from the rear guard action phase towards the roadmap for renewal phase, because we really need to spend the next 2 years preparing for when a new president hopefully takes office in January of 2021 and teeing up for that moment the kind of reforms that we're going to need to protect our democracy for the next generation. The House of Representatives just introduced H.R. 1, which has a whole host of really important democracy reform pieces in it on voting, on ethics, on campaign finance, on gerrymandering. It is not nearly the whole universe of what we will need to do to prevent what we're really afraid of, which is Trump 2.0. Because as scary and dangerous as Donald Trump is for our democracy, one gift he has given us is that he is relatively incompetent. Although, as John Dean has pointed out, presidents, including Nixon, learned the longer they were in office, and Trump is learning how to use the tools of the office. The real fear is that someone's out there waiting in the wings, watching what Trump is doing and saying, oh, the American people are open to this more strongman style of governance, but I can do it better than him. And unless we use the moment in the window after Trump to reinforce the guardrail, that person could have an easier time rising in the future, and then we're really going to be in trouble. And so I think what both at Protect Democracy and throughout the movement we're going to need to do is talk more about the kinds of things that are in our roadmap for renewal, right? We have, for example, relied for years on a norm that the White House does not interfere in specific party matters with the Department of Justice. Well, maybe that norm is not strong enough anymore, and we need something stronger than that. And so I think it's incumbent upon the 2020 candidates, not just all the Democrats, but I hope and expect there will be a Republican challenger, to all approach this campaign and say, look, there's a whole lot of stuff on which we disagree, and we are going to have a vigorous campaign and debate about the things on which we disagree. But we all also agree on some core foundational aspects about American democracy, a lot of the stuff that's in this roadmap for renewal, and we're all committed that no matter which of us win, those things are going to be front of the agenda. And that after we're done having this vigorous debate that's going to happen between 2019 and 2020, whoever emerges as the person who will challenge Donald Trump, we will all unite behind that person, because we held a summit for democracy with the group Stand Up Ideas about a year ago, at which we had a panel of activists and politicians who had challenged autocrats in Russia, Egypt and Poland speaking to us about what their experience was like and what we should learn from it. And I remember that the member of parliament from the opposition party in Poland warned us. The question that was put to her was, what's the one lesson you have for Americans living under Donald Trump concerned about a slide into autocracy? And she said, don't let the opposition fracture. That's what happened in Poland. The opposition fractured it. So as we go through 2019 and 2020, the key aspect is going to be have a vigorous campaign, have a vigorous debate, and then the coalition of all Democratic forces needs to come together again in November of 2020.
Ian Bassin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Michaela Fogel and Matt Kahn for heroic efforts to get usable audio out of a conference call that for some reason just didn't quite work right. And thanks to Ian for his patience with that. Our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only, the Beijing-based Sophia Yan. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. You need to do your part to support it. I bet you haven't done it yet, so go give us a rating, leave us a review, share us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, whatever other podcast sharing things you may have access to, including orally with friends who don't want to hear about us anymore, but keep it coming. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.